Namaste and welcome to the Bharat Varta Weekly. Thank you so much for joining us. Another beautiful Sunday morning here. Hi Ashish, hi Vatsa. How are you guys?
Hi Kari.
Vatsa, the peak seems to have declined here. I think it was closer to 4 lakhs, about 4 lakh cases daily a week back. We've since declined, so some good news, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it looks like we have kind of just about crossed the hump. There's been some good work done by the National COVID-19 Supermodel Committee, and you know, we're looking forward to host Professor Manindra Agarwal, who has done some great work on how they have sort of modeled this epidemic despite the changing characteristics of the virus and so on. So that's going to be an interesting episode next week.
Yeah, absolutely. So as usual, we put out an episode last week where Ashish, Nirav and I spoke about the Central Vista project and, you know, tried to clear some of the misconceptions associated with it. Ashish, I think a lot of people were, very surprised about all of these things, right? I mean, because I think there's just been a whole wholesale campaign on, like, you know, all of the negative impact and effects of the project as such. So, yeah, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I was actually surprised by people's reaction. I mean, a lot of this data is available in public, and simple stuff like the budgets of a project, how are they released each year? For example, if the project is 20,000 crore, doesn't mean the 20,000 crore has been released and spent already. Right?
Precisely.
And this should be intuitive. It doesn't need a lot of understanding of how government works. But somehow people had were looking at headline numbers and reacting to only the more emotional type of arguments. Right? So the response to the episode was been quite good. A lot of comments around how people thought this was quite educative in the sense of understanding what this is all about, what is the real impact, and what is the real opposition, which is quite political. And if you have not heard the episode, I'll urge you to go through this one, which talks about how the delimitation and increase of seats in Lok Sabha is the real reason why the project is getting a lot of criticism in the garb of the pandemic.
All right, on to our first piece of news for the week. As tensions rose on the Gaza Strip, Israel's Iron Dome was in full effect. The Iron Dome system in Israel attracted the world's attention. It's a ground-to-air defense system which uses Tamir interceptors and radars to shoot down unwanted aerial vehicles. And it has been jointly developed by Israel's aerospace industries and Rafael Advanced Defense Systems. The systems can help in detecting, assessing, and interpreting incoming artillery attacks in civilian areas. What's a, I mean, interesting piece of technology, right?
Absolutely. I mean, and considering the kind of neighborhood environment Israel is in, they absolutely need it. They're completely surrounded by a bunch of very unfriendly countries and terror organizations that operate in these countries with active support of governments in that region, right? Iron Dome is a very interesting solution in the sense that it's a very high-tech solution for a very low tech problem, which is essentially rockets which are, you know, fired by militants. It may look straightforward, but it's I think technically it'd be very complex because rockets have a much shorter trajectory and they actually land on their targets much sharper, and a lot of them end up getting misfired as well. I'll come to that later. So it intercepts about 90% of all rockets fired. They started on this in 2011, and this was operational in 2011. I mean, as I mentioned, it's rockets are different from missiles in the sense that missiles are more predictable sort of trajectories and are in the air for much longer time. To kind of give a very crude analogy, it's like someone like Michael Jordan jumping in the air and hanging there for like 3 seconds versus someone like you and me jumping and probably falling off in, you know, at 10th of that, right? So it's going to be difficult to aim at someone who is not going to be in the air at that long. It's quite similar to the Patriot system that was used in the first Gulf War, when Iraq somehow decided that they had to target Israel through Scud missiles. So Israel already has different materials for ballistic missiles and air attacks and so on. So while it's a great defensive system, the way they hit back has not changed, which is still through airstrikes, artillery fire, and so on. I mean, having 90% accuracy on a system like this is pretty phenomenal, right? I mean, some 350 rockets fired by the Hamas have actually landed within Gaza itself. So that's how erratic those rockets are. And then to be able to intercept them and make sure they don't, you know, hit civilian targets is pretty phenomenal. I think that the considering the scale, it does seem like Hamas thinks that Hamas, I should say. I'm very hungry, that's why I mentioned Hamas. But I mean, they think that if they launch more rockets, then they're more likely to kind of get through and hit their targets. But what they forget is they're hitting more of their own people as well. So I do hope good sense prevails, because what Israel has is a pretty solid solution to this problem. I think it's needed, considering the unique situation they are in geographically, and you know how they are surrounded by some of the most unfriendly of nations.
Right. Yeah. Something of a spectacle for sure to behold. In other news, the Nicobar transshipment port announced last year has been cleared for the first hurdle. The port, along with other infrastructure projects on the Great Nicobar Island, were approved by the Environment Appraisal Committee. The plan proposes the construction of a transshipment terminal, a greenfield international airport, a township and area development, and a 450 megavolt amperes power plant. Currently, nearly 25% of Indian container traffic is transshipped through foreign ports, losing out on a potential revenue of up to $200 million annually. The new port at Nicobar could take on a majority of India's transshipping operations. Ashish, this seems like a boost to the shipping industry, right?
This is a very interesting project. So transshipment is a concept which is splitting the larger pieces of cargo into smaller ones on ships. As we know, the ships today are humongous in size and they cannot berth at all the ports. And when you are shipping to smaller ports, and like in India there are like literally hundreds of small ports on both West and East Coast. So all the big cargo ships cannot dock in every of those ports, right? So what happens on a transshipment is a concept where these ships will go to a large port from where the cargo is unloaded onto smaller ships. So it's like the old concept of the railway junctions where the feeder lines used to meet, right? So it's a similar concept, basically. Bulk of the transshipment to India happens today via Colombo or Singapore, which are well-developed ports. Now, this is a very strategic location. Great Nicobar is the southernmost island. So in the chain of Andaman and Nicobar, this is like the southernmost island that is there. So which means that it is fairly close to Indonesia, Malaysia, Sri Lanka, of course, the Indian East Coast, and a host of other countries in Southeast Asia. So this port can potentially take away, take the load of not just India's transshipment, but also can become a very attractive destination for outside of Colombo and Singapore. I think that's the biggest advantage for the location of the Great Nicobar Island. Now, the problem here is that, of course, this is a very environmentally sensitive zone. And although the project was announced in August, September 2000, we are still at the stage of the environmental clearances and so on. The project itself is about $10 billion and it will probably take like a better half of a decade, better part of the decade to get cleared. What has happened this week, and which is why we're covering here, is that the first the clearance for environmental study has been given. So it's not that the project has been cleared by the MOEF, the Ministry of Environment and Forests, but they've agreed to do a study to undertake the project, right? So the terms of reference for the study have been granted. And this is important because a lot of projects get nixed at that level. The projects which are environmentally sensitive do not even make it to the study phase in many cases. And that's the hurdle which this project has crossed. There is the committee which the Ministry of Environment and Forest appoints. It's headed by Deepak Apte, who's a marine biologist and the former director of the Bombay Naturalistic Society. So this committee met on March 17th and 18th and then later on in April, on April 5th and 6th. And they evaluated a 126-page pre-feasibility report, which then was taken on board and taken into account. And now the permission has been given to do a full-fledged environmental study, which if it is cleared, will then pave the way for the actual construction. Of course, it will need the closure of the project operationally and financially. So still some way to go. But interesting development. This was envisaged only in August, September of last year. And as I said, it's probably going to take like a decade to finally get to the plans which you mentioned, Carrie.
Right. Okay, moving on. USA's largest pipeline for refined oil products was hit by a cyber attack last Friday. Eastern European hacker group DarkSide were confirmed to be responsible for the attack. However, after government pressure from the FBI and other regulators, they announced that they were going out of business. DarkSide, that is. On the flip side, the company seems to have paid the ransom demanded by the hackers. According to officials familiar with the matter, Colonial paid DarkSide nearly $5 million within hours of the attack. After the payment was made in cryptocurrency, the hackers provided Colonial with a decryption tool, which was reportedly extremely slow. What's a interesting turn of events? I mean, what are your thoughts?
So interesting, right? I mean, the fact that a group can provide a ransomware as a service and then bring the most advanced industrial nation to its knees, at least a part of it, in terms of its fuel needs, right? I mean, Colonial itself supplies about 45% of the fuel needed for the East Coast, 100 million gallons a day. So it's not a small amount of fuel that moves around. We still don't know how the attack took place. Probably Colonial will have to do some sort of forensic analysis, get it done, you know, probably get NSA involved as well to find out what exactly happened. Because these kind of attacks are national security threats. Make no mistake about it. If critical infrastructure can be brought down by a group of hackers, it can bring an entire nation down on its knees very quickly. So DarkSide is an interesting group in the sense that they portray themselves as some sort of modern day Robin Hoods, right? They donate money, and a lot of charities have refused money that they've sent through Bitcoin and other cryptos, because of the source of these funds. Colonial has been hit pretty badly. It's taken them roughly about 5 to 6 days to slowly get their systems back on track, and it's still fully not, you know, there. Initially, they had to ask some of their employees to kind of move some of the fuel manually across 5,000 miles of the gas pipeline. It does ask some serious questions of the cybersecurity infrastructure, critical cybersecurity infrastructure. What are the policies in place within the US in terms of, whether they have standards, whether they have requirements that companies need to follow to ensure things like this don't happen. And it clearly does appear that there weren't, that many guidelines, etc., or oversight in place from the government side. What the US government has quickly done is they've passed an executive order whereby they have highlighted certain key areas, which is to protect federal networks, set some standards for security of commercial software. In today's world where a lot of software is available on the cloud by third-party providers, so security also kind of gets outsourced to some of these larger players, be it, AWS, Azure, and so on. Instead of companies owning it themselves, there definitely needs to be a lot of collaboration between the private and government sectors to ensure that these kind of attacks don't happen. And the entire sort of supply chain of software whereby different components and systems, they come together for the running of a company. And cybersecurity needs to be looked at that holistic level, you know, by all of these companies. And government should ideally come up with some sort of a playbook or, you know, on how to deal with these kind of attacks. Because every successful attack emboldens, you know, these hackers even more. And since they use crypto to kind of demand, you know, their ransom, etc., the transactions are virtually undetectable. There are ways in which you can make it next to impossible to find out where the money has gone. So there has to be a lot of work done. And I think even in India, we need to focus on some of these things. We already have a national electricity grid, which is largely software driven. We've spoken about, you know, the gas grid that is proposed, and all of these are potential sort of areas of attack for hackers. So I think for us, it's important to take this lesson and then try to evolve, start off with evolving some sort of policy, and then also have the kind of operational mechanism in place to deal with these kind of threats. I think for India, that's the important lesson.
Yeah. The Modi government has appointed uniformed defense personnel to the Ministry of Defense. This move means that the officers can directly participate in the bureaucratic decisions instead of routing them through the secretary or DMA. The Department of Military Affairs was created to look after the affairs of each branch of the armed forces. They mainly focus on procurement and promoting jointness in training and staffing of the services. According to sources, the move is a historic and landmark moment for the armed forces in the country. Ashish, do you think this will finally cut down the amount of red tape, especially when it comes to, you know, procurement and things to that effect in defense?
This is a very interesting move, actually. As we know, there's been a constant conflict between the bureaucracy and the defense officials when it comes to the budget allocations and other related discussions for the armed force personnel. Those kind of conflicts were also responsible for the delays in OROP and so on. So in January of last year, January 2020, the government had created a department called the DMA, Department of Military Affairs, which was supposed to create a common vision for all the three forces, right? And General Rawat was appointed the first Chief of Defense Staff earlier in 2019. He's also the secretary to this department, which is under the Ministry of Defense. So in that sense, he was given the first quote-unquote bureaucratic role coming from an armed forces background to run one of the departments, which was then, as you said, was responsible for streamlining procurement and so on. But also more than the procurement piece, the idea was to potentially create integrated theater commands to bring three forces together. And of course, the fact that he's now seen as a single advisor to the defense minister on the matters of national security. So as such, the role of General Rawat as CDS, which is a 3-year term till 2023, and the formation of the Department of Military Affairs, I think this was both quite significant. What has happened this week is that the government has now made permanent four defense personnel who go into the roles of secretaries. So there's Lieutenant General Anil Puri, who's been appointed as the additional secretary in the department. And then there is Major General K. Narayanan, Rear Admiral Kapil Mohan Dheer, and Air Vice Marshal Hardeep Benz. So they've been appointed as joint secretaries. All four of these individuals were already doing that function. I mean, they were essentially already acting as additional or joint secretaries. But this has not been formally recognized by the government. So what it means is that they now can take a decision on moving of files, procure, signing off on budgets, etc., as the powers are given to the joint and additional secretaries in the bureaucratic structure. And this would, of course, then make decision making more, not just more decentralized at that level, but also the fact that this can be within the defense forces. It would not have to go to other members of the bureaucracy in some of the aspects. This, as just to clarify, I mean, DMA is just one of the five different verticals in the defense ministry. There's also Department of Defense, Defense Production, Defense Research, and the ex-service welfare departments. But at least on the side of the creating the strategy for procurement and creating more indigenization, etc., I think this department can take a much bigger role. And that decision can then be housed within the defense personnel or within the armed forces. So pretty interesting development. Need to see if, like lateral entry in other departments, you can call this like a lateral entry for defense of defense personnel and of serving defense personnel in this case. So needs to be seen if this is expanded or if this is a one-off initiative which the government has taken. But yes, this will certainly give more legroom for the armed forces to make their own decisions on some of the critical aspects, and hence tilt the balance, the power balance towards them in the long-standing differences with the administrative setup.
Yeah, definitely interesting. In more interesting news, Vitalik Buterin, the creator of the Ethereum cryptocurrency, has donated $1.1 billion to India's COVID relief fund. Buterin's donation to the fund has been dubbed the mother of all donations and is the largest philanthropic effort for COVID relief in India so far. He donated 500 Ethereum coins and a portion of his 50 trillion Shiba Inu coins for the relief. However, the Shiba Inu coins' value fell by over 30% after his donation. It is unlikely that India will receive the complete $1.1 billion of donation. The India COVID Relief Fund converts its crypto through an entity set up in UAE. These funds are then sent to Indian NGOs through the FCRA route, basically. What's a interesting development? What do you make of this?
So I think it's an interesting test case, right? So I think one of the problems that has existed with crypto transactions is the pace at which they happen. Although that's also improving significantly with, you know, the newer architectures and so on. A transaction on Ethereum, takes around 15 minutes for confirmation. In the newer versions of newer softwares or newer platforms, this is like come down to a second, which is still slower than, you know, what happens through regular banking channels, etc. But it's a big step forward. And I see this as a test case for, you know, how you can use crypto for more mainstream funding, right? The interchangeability between crypto and fiat currencies, how quickly these transactions can happen while following all the regulations, all the compliances, KYC, AML, etc. And such a big donation coming through is kind of a test case for India, because just looking at the amount that, you know, I think FATF will come into picture, bunch of other regulations and compliances will come into the picture. So how we handle all of this, while it may take some time for all the money to come through, I think the more interesting part is that, apart from the fact that it is the obvious fact that it is welcome relief, you know, considering how starved we are of some of the resources in this difficult time. So it's obviously it's a great gesture by Vitalik Buterin, but this might also, I think, change the mind of, you know, our regulators, who have been very headstrong when it comes to crypto. They just want to ban it, but the fact is, in today's world, crypto is accepted as some sort of an asset class. It may not be a currency in the true sense of the word, mainly in my opinion, because it fluctuates too much and is not stable enough to be a currency, but it can definitely be looked at as an asset class. And, you know, I think the RBI will probably look at it a little more seriously. The fact that crypto is not just, you know, a tool for speculation and used by traders to make money, etc., but it can also do some good. So that's how I'm looking at it. It'll test because of the sheer scale, 50 trillion coins, and the transactions will happen in tranches. The sheer scale, you know, some of the infrastructure around this gets tested. The RBI hopefully starts looking at crypto more positively. at least as an asset class or a commodity, if not a currency. And the fact that this improves that entire crypto sort of ecosystem, the entire platforms which are built on the crypto ecosystem, makes them more efficient. So net, I think those are some of the bit larger benefits that I see, apart from the welcome aid to India.
Yeah, shout out to Sandeep Nelwal, who is the founder of Polygon, who set up the COVID relief fund actually, right? Yeah. And yeah, this is pretty amazing. I was surprised that it wasn't like mainstream news for at least here, right? I mean, it should have been maybe the first page news at least, because $1 billion is a lot of cash. And, you know, even given the fluctuation or whatever, like what's a few hundred million dollars among friends, right? So, yeah. Okay, moving on. The World Health Organization has praised Uttar Pradesh's door-to-door testing model. The WHO lauded the state's effort in micro-planning, house visits, concurrent monitoring and follow-ups. This move is made to contain transmission through rapid isolation, disease management and contact tracing. Each monitoring team has two members who test everyone with rapid antigen tests. Positive tests are tested using an RT-PCR at home. Two mobile vans have been allocated to each block in a district. Those with systems are tested and given medicine kits and information on quarantining and isolation. Ashish, this kind of last mile connectivity is really what we need to prevent some of the rural outbreaks, right?
Yes. So UP, of course, has had a rural outbreak already. But on the flip side, UP is also one of the states which has tested the in big numbers every day since the start of the pandemic, right? So they've typically been doing 1 lakh plus tests for, I think, since last year. And on peak, it has also been like 2.5 lakhs, 2.6 lakhs a day. And a lot of that is coming from the door-to-door testing, which the WHO, at least during this wave, WHO has been helping the UP government. On May 10th, the WHO did a full Twitter thread explaining what their involvement is. They've had set up teams of experts who are then essentially training the health workers in the state to go and collect samples door to door. But I think there's much more to this. It's not just testing, but they also enforce quarantine. A lot of times people in villages, if they don't understand how to quarantine or what are the right ways of doing it, these health workers are also kind of becoming the guides towards that. Plus, they're also identifying the vulnerable patients in terms of the need for healthcare and escalating it through the healthcare chain so that the right support need reaches those individuals. The door-to-door teams are also giving medicines, the predefined set of medicines to different, to the patients, and also, of course, encouraging people for vaccination. There was a suggestion on Twitter that maybe they could also actually do the vaccination for healthy people should that protocol be developed. So maybe that is the next step for this process. But I think it's good to see that WHO has got involved in probably what's the most vulnerable state. I mean, UP and Bihar, given their expanse and the population density and a big chunk of rural population in both the states. It would be good if WHO actually supported some of these initiatives more broadly and more vocally. But I think good that during wave two, at least they have come forward for helping the state government. I think also this can become a template for other states. Should there be a wave three, the challenge, as we know, that's being talked about is that the wave three could impact children, because that's one set of population which is completely not exposed to the virus today, staying indoors. And of course, they also don't have the vaccination done. So in case the virus spreads again, that population could then become vulnerable in the next wave. So to manage the condition of children, the whole door-to-door experience may come handy, because they are less likely to need hospitalization, etc. But at the same time, they could be much more difficult to manage for parents, especially if parents have not got the virus yet or the vaccination yet, right, by the time the third wave strikes. So I hope the WHO kind of evolves this into a more broader guideline framework, which can be used not just in India, but elsewhere as well.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so that's a wrap from us for this week. Coming up next week, we have a couple of, actually, we have more than a couple of episodes. I mean, the way things have been going, I mean, you know, the scheduling is all over the place, right? I mean, things are stacking up and we're not able to do our regular Tuesdays and Thursdays. But I mean, if you look at it on aggregate, I think we're still clocking about 8-10 episodes a month, right? So we have a couple of very good episodes coming up. Modinomics, I had probably a 90-minute chat with Harsh yesterday, which we're going to, you know, release in some time, maybe today in about an hour's time, right? Where we spoke about Harsh's earlier articles and musings on Modinomics itself, right? On building state capacity, structural reforms, monetary policy, fiscal policy, etc. And it was a really, really fascinating deep dive into all of those aspects, looking at how things have panned out since the 4 or 5 years that he first made these statements, right? And also much awaited, I mean, we discussed some of the post-pandemic growth that India can have, what that will look like and so on. So definitely, definitely something that you guys should check out. Ashish, another very interesting episode coming up, the early cancer detection one with the Tripathis.
Yes, I'm quite excited about this one. We should be recording it in the next few days and it should release probably next week. The two brothers between their firms called Zar Labs and Epigenetis have had a breakthrough on early cancer detection through non-invasive methods. I mean, just through a blood test, basically. And if this is accepted in general, and if this is put to use, and of course, if it you know, gets adopted in the medical fraternity, this could be a huge innovation for a disease which is one of the biggest killers in India and globally, and one of those innovations coming out of India. I mean, we have also, of course, interviewed Bhavna Roy and Amish Tripathi earlier for their books. I think Amish has appeared a couple of times. So this would complete the entire family lineup, all the siblings coming on Bharat Varta. So I'm quite excited about this episode. We also have a few others lined up. Actually, let me talk about them while we're talking about future episodes, right? So I speak to Mr. D.V. Sridharan today, who is one of the biggest patrons of the Indic ecosystem. He has written a book called Good News India, which was published a couple of months ago. So that so that's one, the pipeline. Then there's a conversation with Tuhin Sinha and Clark Prasad, who have written a very interesting book called Mission Shenzhen, which is essentially a novel, but points towards the dangers of bioweapons and a bio-war. We will also be joined, hopefully, by Maruf Raza, who's one of the foremost defense analysts in India for the conversation. So that's also planned very, very soon. Then there is a conversation happening with Anil Padmanabhan, who's one of the senior journalists who will talk about India's response to the second wave of COVID. And this will be an episode which we'll do jointly along with the Commonwealth friends, the Conservative Friends of Commonwealth, the UK body with which we have done a couple of episodes already in the past. And then, of course, as Vatsa mentioned, to start off in the episode, we speak to Professor Manindra Agarwal of IIT Kanpur, which will be a live episode on Sunday 23rd in the evening, where he talks about his model on the prediction of the COVID cases in India. So, yeah, I mean, fairly busy May coming up. I think, as you said, Carrie, I mean, we will get to 8-9 episodes a month, but unfortunately, there's a lot of stacking up happening this week and next week. But I guess, you know, that's par for the course during these times where people are also not always available for recordings and they have their own family issues and so on.
Exactly. Yeah, do stay tuned on our social channels. And of course, I mean, you know, thank you so much for your love and support. Keep those comments and suggestions coming in. Do also check out our premium subscription plans on YouTube. There is a Plus and the Prime that gives you access to a variety of premium only content, and also you get a chance to you know, participate in AMAs on a monthly basis. Thank you so much again for joining us. From Ashish, Vatsa and myself, do take care of yourself, stay indoors, stay safe, and see you next week.